Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You take your car in for inspection and find out you need hundreds of dollars in repairs. Your boiler goes out right as the cold weather sets in. You or your kid breaks an arm, and you have a lot of money to pay before your deductible is met and insurance kicks in. How would you shoulder an unexpected $1,000 burden? Braun Research surveyed more than 800 people as part of the VPR Vermont PBS Rural Life Survey and This Land Project, and 40% say they would struggle to repay that amount right away. So today we're using that question as our launching pad to talk about the financial challenges of living in Vermont and where there is help to cover basic costs or even get ahead, save, buy a house, get more education. Joining us for this conversation is Liz Scharf, Director of Community Economic Development and an accredited financial counselor for Capstone Community Action. She works mainly with low-income clients in central Vermont, and she's a frequent guest here. Hi, Liz. Nice to have you back.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from people who have thoughts on this and who are, you know, sharing their own ideas about how $1,000 might affect them. And Stephen wrote in on our Facebook page to say, yep, not if my life literally depended on it could I shoulder a $1,000 burden. Stephen writes, no emergency repair bills, no unexpected or expected medical treatments, no replacement or repairs if a major appliance breaks. After taxes and bills, the only areas I can cut from are groceries and the occasional medication. So listeners, what about you? Could you cover an extra $1,000 burden? 40% of Vermonters in our survey said no, or at least that it would be difficult. Only 11% of Vermonters live in poverty, according to census data. So this isn't necessarily something that just affects very low-income people. And we know that. We know that anecdotally. But seeing it very starkly there is a reminder of the financial challenges of living here and the financial challenges so many of us face. Liz, does that 40% number surprise you?
No, it doesn't. And as Stephen was saying, you know, the poverty level is, as you said, 11%. But that actual measurement is really out of sync with what it costs to live in Vermont. So it's quite possible that Stephen doesn't even fall into that 11%. But there's all these folks in between the official poverty line and what we would call, say, a living wage in Vermont for folks who are struggling and not having the opportunity to save money because they've got high costs in housing, in transportation, childcare, and food. So it doesn't surprise me in the least.
I mean, I know this is different for every person and every household and every family, but just to give us a sense, I mean, how much do you have to make before you stop worrying about a $1,000 expense? I mean, that's a genuine question.
Yeah. So if you were to look at, say, what the living wage is, so we often look at the MIT livable wage calculator, and it tells us that if you live in, say, Rutland County, if you're an adult, two adults, both working with two children, you need to earn around $65,000, a little bit more than $65,000. Does that
to do what?
To live.
To just basically
right.
live. That is not to
live.
Be able to save or to take an extra
right.
$1,000.
So, you know, you're really looking at folks in a higher income category who are able to save. Now, some folks can save for, say, retirement, and that's, you know, a separate type of savings. But when we're talking about emergency savings and being able to get that car repaired or replace the boiler, that's harder for folks to do. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if you had changed that number to $500. You would probably have the same percentage of people not able to save $500 either, because it's, you know, it's very challenging to allocate the dollars that we have. Wages have been stagnant, and the cost of living in Vermont has definitely gone up, and the wages haven't kept up with it. So those expenses are all still there. Whether you're married or you're a single parent, you still need to pay for rent. You still need to pay for transportation. You still need to pay for childcare. So it's really hard to save.
You know, I think for some people, that question, you know, you might answer, yeah, it would be really hard for me to pay off immediately, but I could put it on a credit card. Now, certainly there are stresses around that. You know, can you pay off the monthly, you know, the monthly amount that you need to pay off? Can you get it paid off soon enough so that you're not really getting stuck with, you know, $1,500 that you're paying off? But for some people, just getting a credit card is not a possibility. They don't have a credit card, or it's a, you know, a home repair where you need to basically pay cash. They don't take a credit card. They want you to give them actual cash or money on hand that you might not have in your checking account. I mean, so this is not just, can you throw it on a credit card? For some people, it's, I can't even come up with $1,000 in any form, right?
Right. So there are a number of people in Vermont who do not have access to credit. And that is a significant reason why they can't get ahead. So credit isn't just a credit card. It's also access to a home loan or access to an affordable car loan. So those opportunities to, you know, put it on a credit card are not available to everyone. And so that becomes even harder for them. But even for the folks who do have the opportunity to put it on a credit card, they may not be able to pay it back. So what we often see, and this happens in many households, is there's money to pay all the bills, but people end up just paying the minimum on their credit card and then putting all of their expenses back on the credit card. So they're unable to actually get their balances to go down at an expense of a really high interest rate for those products and services that they're paying for.
Yeah. So then you end up 6 months later actually owing more than the original
exactly.
bill was.
Right.
In a story on the results of the poll on who can and who can't cover an unexpected expense, VPR reporter Liam Elder Connors spoke with a couple of people. And I want to play some of what they said, because it helps illuminate these stories. So one of them is Nicole Forgan and her partner, Pat Ducharme, and they have three kids. They make about $62,000 between the two of them, and they live in Milton. And Forgan says money is always tight and there's nothing left over to save.
Well, prioritize. I make sure that the kids have food. That's my main goal, that they have what they need. And then whatever is left over, then we pay for bills or mortgage or whatever. It's sad that we have to go that far. I would love to save, but there's no saving when you have to do that.
And Liz Scharf, that goes to what you were saying. You know, you could be making $60,000 or more and still feeling like you're prioritizing what you're paying, and you may not be able to pay off all of your expenses every month, but just making sure your kids have food is, you know, obviously a high priority for this family, and reasonably so. Liam also spoke with Michael Currier, who lives in St. Albans. He and his wife, Lynn, are both on disability, and Michael also works part-time as a housekeeper at an assisted living facility, and that means that they earn too much money to qualify for food stamps. Currier says part of the issue is that things they need are just more expensive now.
We go and we spend $300 on groceries, and I'm walking out of the store with less than a cart full. When we first got married, I walked out of there with about three carts full.
Liz Scharf, is that true? I mean, are groceries more expensive? Is everything more expensive compared to wages than it used to be?
Yeah, I would say yes, for sure. And I think that one of the problems, and you've probably been hearing about it on the news, is that the federal administration is looking at cutting benefits for food stamps or SNAP, the SNAP program. And there's a lot of folks that currently receive food stamps who are working folks. And it may be that they're only getting $150 a month, but that's a grocery cart. And as this gentleman was saying, maybe it's only
maybe half a grocery
cart. But it is real dollars that are helping support this family and keeping them, you know, able to meet their other monthly obligations. And to take away those benefits from these working families is going to cause hardship to the working families as well as the older Vermonters who are currently living on fixed incomes and who may rely on just those small benefits to help them get through the month.
But you also work with people, right, for whom a raise may not be the good thing that we would necessarily think it is. You know, if you get a raise and you're suddenly a little bit higher, you could hit that benefits cliff and wind up with a net negative. I mean, that doesn't
yes.
seem fair.
And that is definitely a situation that happens with a number of clients that I work with, where they come to me and they literally say, I had to turn down a raise or I had to turn down hours because if I did, it would take away my health care benefit or it would take away my rental assistance. And this isn't where everyone is having, you know, their entire food is paid for by food stamps or their entire rent is paid for by rental assistance. These, we may just be talking a couple hundred dollars in a subsidy that's helping them make it through the month. But if they get a raise, they lose that subsidy and the raise doesn't equal the amount that they would be replacing when that subsidy disappears. And so it's a net loss in income. And I mean, that to me is, you know, unconscionable that we would be telling people to not take a raise or to work fewer hours. They want to work, but they also need to have health insurance, to have their medications. They need to provide shelter for themselves and their children. So, you know, it is a struggle.
What do you advise people? I mean, are you in the position of actually saying, I think you should turn down that raise?
Sometimes I do, unfortunately. Or, you know, I have them, we really have to, and this is the thing about the quote unquote benefits cliff. Now, I do want to give credit to Vermont. Vermont has a lot of really good policies that help lower income Vermont, you know, not necessarily suddenly have this to face the benefits cliff. But it often is the situation where someone is getting benefits, they have a family, and that extra income is actually going to harm them. And so it doesn't, you know, when we're talking about someone's health, I'm not going to tell them to stop taking your seizure medication and get a raise and hope that you don't have a seizure. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say stop working as many hours and keep your health care benefit.
You don't necessarily advise employers in the same way that you do just regular people. But what should employers do? I mean, there are a lot of employers who want to do the right thing and want their employees both to be well compensated, to work hard for the organization, and not to find themselves in financial straits. And so, you know, there are a lot of business considerations. But, you know, for employers who are like, look, I feel like I'm trying to do the best thing, but I don't know what to do. If you're telling me that, you know, my employee might wind up worse off if I give them more hours, you know, what should the employer do?
Right. So, and I will say a lot of employers in Vermont are really doing a really good job in terms of offering, you know, $15 starting wages, which, you know, are considered somewhat, you know, going towards a livable wage. And so I think that's great. And I don't want to stop employers from doing that. I think that folks do need to appreciate that, you know, if an employer is offering a benefits package, which includes health insurance or retirement and a decent wage, that's a good thing. I want them to keep doing that. And not everyone is in that position, you know, who may need to rely on benefits. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of complicated factors that come into play when you're thinking about things like the benefits cliff. And there's lots of different rules and regulations around so many different programs. But what I do want to stress is that, you know, poverty doesn't have to be permanent. You know, there are a lot of great programs out there that help people move out of poverty, like the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, home ownership programs for lower income folks. At Capstone, we've got great programs that really are designed to not just be a handout, but a hand up to help people move into better economic self-sufficiency. So it's out there.
We can talk more about some of those programs and things like, you know, what kind of credits or loans or grants can you get for education if you think that maybe a higher degree would help you get that better job at a higher rate? You know, how do you actually get the finances together to make that move that you know eventually would probably help you out, but you can't sort of get over the hump to get there? Or, you know, things like home ownership that you talked about, ways that you could actually invest your money differently if you had a little bit more to start with, or if you could get to that position, or if you could get the loan. Allie in Richmond wrote in to say, my husband and I are a recently married young couple who moved to Vermont from upstate New York in January. We love it, and we're considering starting a family in the next few years. My husband is a data analyst, and I'm a skilled lumber worker, both in-demand professions in the local job market. The problem with staying, we don't know if we can afford to, or if we should, given what we would get out of our taxes as a young couple looking to start a family. Allie goes on to say, we're starting to talk about the decision we need to make sooner rather than later, and it's difficult to legitimize staying here with these considerations. Vermont needs young families. Don't push couples like us out before we even start one. And Christine is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Christine.
Hello. This is a great conversation, and the work that Capstone does is terrific as far as financial literacy and educating. And I think this is really a cultural problem as well, because people are not facing the emotional side of what this is doing in life. And to be able to actually save money, you have to just change behaviors a little bit. And I'm not saying everyone can do it, but because there is some real poverty out there with the low wages. And as was pointed out about the baskets, like the inflation at the grocery store, but there is a behavioral piece that really is some underlying emotional, we can't do it because we didn't see our family save money and we didn't see our family get out of poverty. So I think that emotion and sometimes pride can get in the way of people asking for enough help, along with everything else you've addressed. So I just wanted to bring that up along with the cliffs, and the we need to rise the wage, that there is a huge emotional component here. And I've worked with individuals for a long time, and that is the piece that has to be addressed.
Well, Christine, thank you for raising that. And some other people bring in some of the ways that people think about money, the way they think about themselves as well. Nancy wrote in with, you know, Christine mentions not everybody has seen saving in their family. Christine says differently, my parents taught me anyone can save. They both grew up in very rural New Hampshire. Both were deeply poor. My dad would plow snow and sell cordwood for extra money. When he had $100, he bought a high-quality stock. Discipline. He made a plan and stuck with it. And Paul says rural life is Vermont life. When I was growing up here, we often heard the phrase keeping up with the Joneses, and it was something to avoid. Don't try to live up to standards that others live by. Be grateful for what you have and don't worry about what you don't. Be humble in your successes. Your family is your responsibility and no one else's. Help your neighbor to the extent that it doesn't cost your own family and responsibilities. So Liz Scharf, you know, as Christine pointed out, there is real deep poverty and there are real challenges. But what piece of it is this question of maybe just not knowing, not having the financial literacy or the emotional component of, you know, trying to scrimp and save all the time is exhausting and it's just hard to do it and hard to see a path through. So to Christine's point of, you know, sort of emotional behavior, where do you see that?
So, and there, yes, for sure, I always call that sort of the emotion, like what are the costs of debt? One of the costs is an emotional debt, and it can actually affect your health negatively. But I also think that a lot of what's going on, especially in poverty, is trauma. And we have to be a more trauma-informed community to understand why some people have a harder time than others. And I don't know the answer to that. There can be families where, you know, all the siblings experienced something very similar and some have been able to move out and of poverty and some haven't. And why that is the case, I don't know. But I think that we need to have a little bit more empathy for folks. And you know, at Capstone, one of the things that one of our missions that we've discovered is that we really do want to work with our clients to give them a voice, to give them a platform in which they can share their stories and talk with the greater community about the struggles and the successes that they face. And so I think that, you know, by not ignoring the situation and understanding that there's a story behind every single person's inability to save or anyone's inability to get out of poverty, that I think that we would be better off as a community having more of that empathy and understanding.
Along with that empathy and understanding, you know, is there a piece that if you didn't learn this stuff from your family, and if you didn't get financial literacy classes in high school, I mean, you're sometimes at a loss. I didn't know how to have a credit card when I got out of college. It just, you know, it wasn't something that anybody had taught me. And I I mean, I could figure it out. I could read about it. But like, I didn't know how to do that and how important it is to your credit to pay off a bill. You know, don't sign up for the store credit card just because they offer it. Like, it, that stuff was confusing to me. And I feel like, you know, I had pretty good role models around money. So I think a lot of people are really operating from a deficit just from the start in how to have a financially stable life.
Agreed. And, you know, thankfully, the schools in Vermont are looking at, you know, having more schools offering financial literacy as a requirement for graduation, which I think is great. And, you know, you do role models definitely help. But I mean, I agree with you. There's a lot about, you know, credit I didn't know. I just got a credit card when I graduated from high school. Everyone was offering one. And I think that there is this temptation. And the reality, too, is that, you know, as we've been talking this morning, there may not be enough money to actually pay all the bills. So you might have to put stuff on credit. And once you start building credit, you know, it's pretty easy to build credit. And it's really easy to have your credit get destroyed very quickly because of, you know, the inability to get all your bills paid. And so, you know, I think that education is important, but and having good role models is important. You know, I'll work with folks and show them the difference between a high interest car loan and a low interest car loan. And it can be $10,000 more that they're paying for the same monthly payment because the interest rate is higher. And people's jaws drop. They say, "What? I had no idea." So there is, you know, there's definitely a lot of education that still needs to happen.
Right. I mean, if you think, oh, look, that car loan is a 4%. And then, you know, the person who's getting it, who doesn't have great credit, is getting it at 9 or 10%. That's a
or
big difference.
Or 20%.
Yeah. 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 And that's a lot more money that person is paying than you are for the same car
exactly.
loan.
Exactly.
Today, we're talking with Liz Scharf, Director of Community Economic Development at Capstone Community Action, where she works mainly with low-income clients in central Vermont, kind of down the spine of Vermont, actually, on financial issues. We started with the question from our rural life survey. Could you weather an unexpected $1,000 expense? 40% of our survey respondents said they'd have trouble paying off that kind of bill right away. Kathleen writes in to say, "I'm listening to your show from the Upper Valley of New Hampshire, and as a parent of 3 20-plus-year-olds in college, I can tell you that I worry about them. Even with a college degree, my oldest daughter cannot get a job in her chosen field for more than $15 an hour. With the cost of rent, gas, and food, she cannot pay for unexpected bills. We're still helping her financially so that she can get her master's degree and then perhaps be able to stand on her own financially. The cost of goods and living in this area do not match the wages that are being paid here. If we want young people to live and work here, we need to make major changes to ensure they can stay where they grew up." And Mark says, "I'm not kidding. $18 an hour is the breakover point at which you can finally start to gain a little traction here. Anything less than that, and you're spinning your wheels trying to maintain a lifestyle in Vermont." He says, "Vermont is a very expensive state, yet we invite potential second and third homeowners here with purchase incentives to jack up the prices of everything from real estate to food even more and make it worse for everyone." Lisa in Brookline also writes in with a similar thought here on people who are coming in who are maybe making other things more expensive for people who already live here. She writes, "My husband is a Vermonter and we've lived here for 30 years, raising 3 children. Our oldest child returned to Vermont with her husband, also a Vermonter, 5 years ago, and they live in Burlington, renting an apartment. They've been actively trying to buy a house for almost 2 years and keep running up against cash buyers who bid up the house prices. My husband and I figure many of these buyers are out-of-staters with deep pockets who will likely visit only in certain seasons. The state needs to start looking at this trend and looking at the tax treatment of second homes with a fresh perspective. The out-of-state purchases of second homes should carry a hefty surcharge or a tax, call it whatever you want, and the tax rate on all second homes need to be taxed more than they currently are, with substantial surcharges for homes valued over a certain level. It's time to make purchasing and owning property in Vermont more fair if we're going to be successful in keeping our kids here. This will not stop people from buying homes here either, since climate change is going to drive them here even more." So Liz Scharf, our guest here today, helping us think about these and putting them in perspective and in financial perspective. You know, what do you think about that cost of just trying to get what you see other people getting who maybe have more money and that may make it more expensive for you? Is that happening? Do you see that happening?
Well, what the last person who just wrote in was saying is true, that, you know, if there's a bidding war, you know, you're really at the mercy of what other people have, the deeper pockets. And so it can make homeownership for sort of what we might consider the middle class more difficult because of people coming in from out of state and having more money. But I think the reality is that housing is expensive here. So I think it's something like one in four Vermonters pays more than 50% of their income on rent, and that's a lot of money. And childcare expenses, if you add a kid to the mix, for high-quality childcare, you may be paying $1,000 a month for that.
Or more for an infant.
Or more for an infant, exactly. But at the same time, you know, addressing one of the people who had written in, Allie, I think it was, I think it's important for families to live here. It's a great state to raise your kids. And, you know, it may require sort of the gig economy of having an extra job or working out between the two of you who's going to stay home so that you're not paying 100% child care when you do have a kid. So, you know, there are a lot of challenges.
We have other thoughts, too, from people. Sarah wrote in to say there are systemic issues that make financial stability really out of reach for many people. You can't budget your way out of poverty if you don't have enough to start with. This is a capitalist myth that refuses to die. No amount of budgeting will make $15 an hour enough to live on. Scott says a good example of how the state government compounds the problem is childcare regulation and vehicle inspection regulation. The cost of childcare for a single child is as much as a mortgage, and owning a car for over 6 years or 6 years or old or older requires unnecessary repairs due to stringent requirements that have no impact on vehicle safety. Also, property taxes seem to be rising at an unsustainable rate. Nicole's calling in from Colchester. Nicole, where do you stack up in this conversation?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Colchester with my partner, and we have a 15-month-old daughter, and she's in an amazing child care program that is, you know, quite expensive, but we're very fortunate to be able to afford it. I get a subsidy from my workplace, which helps a lot. And one of the things that I've been feeling as a young family here has just been a sense that it's really a social justice situation with childcare in particular, and probably a lot of services. But I heard the comment earlier about childcare regulations, and I don't think the answer is having less quality childcare. Like, I am so thankful for the childcare that my daughter is in. She's learning and she's growing so much, and I am so upset to know that it's a privilege to have her there, and that other families that don't have as much resources as we do can't afford quality childcare, and their kids are not going to have the same opportunities as we do. And also, my husband is a third-generation Vermonter from the Northeast Kingdom, and we talk about moving closer to his parents someday. I'm not from Vermont myself, but I love it here, and I'm kind of afraid of how we would make that work financially, and it's the only family we have near here. So I just think that people need to really think about it when they say, if you can't have kids, don't afford them. Because if we're talking about childcare costing as much as in-state college tuition, if you're a parent, you can start saving for college when your baby is born. But if you want to start a family, you would have had to start saving when you were in elementary school if you really want to make it affordable if you don't have the means.
Yeah, Nicole, I appreciate your points and your perspective here and using your own family situation as a way to help illuminate those points. Thank you. Let's talk to Nick, who's with us from Fairfax. Nick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Along the lines of illumination, I'd always had phenomenal credit. My parents brought me upright, fortunately, and kind of what's made the turn in my life, unfortunately, was a divorce. Where I'm having to use an intermediary agency to pay out what is 64% of my income, and you know, I'm a disabled combat veteran. And so I earn income in addition to work. And, you know, after that, I was kind of forced to use a credit card. And it's been nearly impossible. And my suggestion is to politicians or legislators that are listening would be not to just pay that money up front, but rather work in a co-parenting type manner where we're splitting the actual cost rather than at the beginning of the month sending 64% of my income and not having any accountability as to what that money is being spent on or if that's the actual amount that's needed. It's just a cold, hard calculus, and that's it.
Nick, thank you. I appreciate that perspective, too. And certainly, you know, when you're trying to raise a child together but living separately, not only is that question of child support payments a really big one for many parents, but also trying to maintain two households. You know, just trying to do that is so difficult. And Nick, I really appreciate you bringing that into the conversation. It's not something that we'd been talking about. I want to bring another email in here, and then Liz, I'd love to get your reflections. Jessica writes, I'm a single mom of four with no support. I'm one of thousands of women here facing the same issue. I recognized when I needed to leave my marriage for safety that the only chance I had here to make a livable wage and provide double income was to return to school. I started my journey to earning my doctorate while I was in a domestic violence shelter. Unfortunately, even with my degrees, Vermont doesn't offer me the ability to make what I thought was the answer a reality. I literally can't afford to leave the home and work the hours I need to after childcare costs and travel. Government, nonprofit, and for-profit organizations alike should be offering a more flexible work schedule. If this were the case, I could afford to work two jobs to supplement the income I need to not only support my family and make ends meet, but maybe even to save a few dollars a month. Lots of different perspectives there, Liz Scharf, that you know are all people who are challenged in different ways and really struggling just to make it work.
Yeah, being a single parent is really hard to actually get ahead when you're a single parent. And as this caller just said, that it requires a large income in order to support your family. And if she's got four kids, that's a struggle. And with the fellow who is going through a divorce, it's the same thing. There's still two households that need to get paid for, and so it just is a. It doesn't afford the opportunity to be able to save or pay down on debt. And, you know, when you're dealing with, especially with a divorce, often what happens is if there's a home involved, one person wants to keep the home, but they don't understand that they actually may need to buy that person out, and then they have to have good credit, and they need to be able to afford a mortgage on their own, and they can't. And so then the struggle is, how are we even going to keep the kids intact in this home on one income? So there's a lot of struggles going on there with being a single parent.
This is really depressing. You said, Liz, there are things that can help. And, you know, we've sort of weighted this more heavily in the favor of people being able to share their struggles and their stories because, A, I think it's illuminating for us to all hear what we're all going through. But, B, people need a place to feel safe and to be able to share what is hard. But, you know, in the 2 minutes that we have left, what are some of the ways that people can at least start thinking about things that you could do or things that you could research to try to get yourself ahead if that extra $1,000 is an expense that you can't imagine being able to pay?
So, you know, there's some interesting apps out there where you can save just a small portion of maybe, you know, where it rounds up your dollars so you can put a little money aside. I would, you know, encourage people to even, you know, think about a way that they can save even $5 a week. Because having that little bit of extra money can go a long way to just, you know, an unexpected expense. And like I said, poverty isn't permanent. You know, it may be tough times, you know, right this very moment for someone, but to actually, you know, be able to get ahead, you know, have that hope that you'll be able to. Because I believe that everyone isn't necessarily going to be in the same situation that they are in today.
If you want to buy a home, are there people who can help you with that? If you want to go to school?
Sure. Yeah. Like if you're interested in, if you don't have a lot of income and you're interested in home ownership, you can visit one of the home ownership centers like Central Vermont. It's down street. They can help you with classes and steer you in the right direction of a loan. We have our Vermont matched savings. So if you save $1,000, you get $1,000, you can use it for a home, higher education, or a small business.
Now, you know, Vermont is a challenging place. We know it's a rural place. We're not alone, though, in these financial challenges, are we? I mean, I know you don't research all of the other states, but this is not a Vermont-specific problem.
It's not Vermont-specific. In fact, Vermont actually does pretty well if you are comparing them to other states. But the reality is that we still have, you know, 16,000 children in poverty. And so, you know, that's a lot of people. And we want to be mindful of how we can help as a state to improve those numbers.
And we'd love to see you Tuesday, October 29th at the Chandler Center in Randolph for Rural Voices on Stage, where many of the issues we've been talking about this week will be brought to life by real Vermonters sharing their lives and stories. You can go to vpr.org to get your tickets to this free event. Liz Scharf is Director of Community Economic Development and an accredited financial counselor for Capstone Community Action. Thank you very much for sharing this conversation with us today, Liz.
Well, thanks. And I just want to say one more thing. If you're looking to save money on winter tires, we've got the Wheels for Warmth this weekend, where you can get tires for as little as $25 each. So go to wheelsforwarmth.org to find out where you can get great, high-quality winter tires for your car.
And we'll put a link to that up at vpr.org.